So, and also use of false flag operations, whether in the U.S. or other places. So with that, I'll turn it back over to you, Fiona. Thank you very much.
Okay. Mark, thank you very much for that very comprehensive overview of the concepts, organizations, and operations of political warfare within the PLA and China more broadly. We'll turn it over to Jacques Delisle to speak about securing Taiwan's international space.
Yeah, so Mark's been talking about all the stuff you can't see. I'm going to talk about some of the things you can see and whether they mean much. What I want to suggest is that Taiwan continues to be engaged in what's been a decades-long struggle to acquire or preserve international space. On international space, especially its formal visible dimensions, matters for international status, how much you like a state, and in turn, security. To put it simply, Taiwan's security is threatened by a bunch of things, some of which you've heard on this panel and on the previous panel, but among the things it's threatened by is its disputed status. And so it exists somewhere along this broad spectrum between mere province of the PRC and fully independent normal state in the international system, and much of the game about international space is sliding along that spectrum, preventing backsliding and trying to move up to the more formal end. And I want to suggest that for decades now, Taiwan has engaged in a multifaceted strategy here that consists of somewhere, depending on how you count it, from 3 to 6 categories of efforts. One is to seek access or membership in international organizations, both the big deal ones, which are hard to get, and the less big deal ones, which are a little more achievable. Secondly, to preserve relations with other states, formal diplomatic relations where possible, and robust informal relations with great powers such as the United States. Finally, to pursue a kind of as-if approach, to behave as if Taiwan were a member of organizations, and particularly multilateral treaties, that it's not allowed to join, while joining the lesser ones that it can get into. This strategy, as I said, goes back at least to the Lee Teng-hui presidency, when a lot of these kinds of attempts were first high on the agenda, but it, of course, has its roots even earlier in Taiwan's loss of international space, starting with UN General Assembly resolution ousting the ROC and giving the seat to the PRC, and, of course, followed quickly by the Taiwan Relations Act, 40th anniversary of that coming up imminently, with the derecognition process for the ROC that was part and parcel of. So the details of the strategy have changed over time. Under Tsai, the strategy has had to adjust to a somewhat colder or chillier environment, mostly coming from Beijing. It's been harder to maintain and certainly to move forward. And this is one of those areas of international politics where there's a relatively substantial intersection with international law, so it makes me happy. It's better in the international system to be a state or to be treated as if you are a state than to be something that is less than that. Law doesn't dictate here, but law kind of tracks the politics, so it makes sense. There are good incentives to try to acquire and preserve international status, international space for international status. And the elements of Taiwan's strategy here have a lot of international law in them. Recognition is a diplomatic and the international legal concept. These international organizations are international legal creatures. Treaties are international legal documents. It gives us something to talk about when we have to teach in law school. And many of the legal tactics now that are boosting Taiwan's status on the U.S. side are, of course, pieces of legislation, the Taiwan Travel Act and other things we'll talk about. So there's a lot of law in this politics. Okay, that's the justification for why you should listen to me. Let me tell you a little bit about sort of what's going on in each of these strategies. So the context or the frame for Taiwan's contemporary pursuit of international space, what's changed, of course, it is Beijing's gotten a little tougher. I mean, this isn't profoundly new, but it's certainly chillier and tougher than it was earlier. Tsai received a cold shoulder for not accepting the One China principle in the 92 consensus, of course. Her acceptance of the ROC constitutional framework and the articles on cross-strait relations, which have a tinge of One China to them, was also rebuffed. And what you've seen is China, of course, through no less an authority than Xi Jinping, restating its long-standing positions on independence in any form is unacceptable, unification is the inevitable end, and one country, two systems, which is even in less good odor, I think, in Taiwan than it was before the Hong Kong incident, is the framework in some sense for doing this. So on to the several elements of Taiwan's pursuit of international space and what they look like today. One piece is to try to get as much access as possible to the biggest deal international organizations. The UN membership itself, of course, it has been off the table since Resolution 2758 in 1971. The Clinton-era three no's has sort of put in place this notion the U.S. won't push for Taiwan's inclusion in full state member-only organizations. And for a time, Taiwan tried to get its allies to push the idea, and of course, Chen Shui-bian did the famous 2008 referendum on whether Taiwan should try to enter the UN under the name Taiwan. That's largely been abandoned or put on the back burner, at least, in quest of a much more measured set of policies which seek engagement with the UN's specialized organs, the things related to it. The big success here, of course, was during the Ma-Ying-jeou era in the World Health Assembly annual meeting, not to be confused with the WHO as an organization. This is just the annual convention, in effect, where Taiwan had ad hoc year-by-year entry, which spilled over a tiny bit into the Tsai era because the invitations went out before the transition, but it's been canceled since then. Similar thing with the ICAO Assembly, again, not the International Civil Aviation Organization itself, but the quadrennial or quinquennial assembly meeting, where I think they were described as special guest.
Triennial.
Okay, that's one of those numbers.
Triennial.
Triennial, right. It was 2016 to 2019. They didn't get to go again. So anyway, they got to go once under Ma, and then have not been renewed. And of course, there's the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Again, not the convention itself, but COP, the convention, the sort of meeting of parties, which get named after wherever you hold it, plus a number. So in that case, Taiwan had some very limited success. Technical delegations have gone a couple times, even under Tsai, but not much progress. And then there's Interpol, which is, of course, not a UN-affiliated organization, but kind of exists in the same space as a big deal, near-universal multilateral member organization, where Taiwan has sought access to the assembly. It had been ousted from the organization itself back in 1984 when China was admitted. So that's Tsai's list, and it largely was Ma's list, and the modest gains have eroded, have been taken back. Secondly, there are other international organizations, especially international economic organizations, and there Taiwan's done pretty well. Full membership of the WTO is part of the same deal that got China in, with Taiwan straddling the calendar year, so it looked like they didn't enter quite at the same time. And having to do it under the somewhat prolix name of the separate customs territory of Taiwan, Jinmen, Penghu, and Mazu, paren, Chinese Taipei, close paren. Try putting that on your name tag. But membership there has remained relatively secure, no real threats to it. And Tsai even took a step forward to position Taiwan as a member in good standing by dropping what was really irrelevant, that is Taiwan's developing country status. It didn't mean anything anymore, but it was a nice gesture. The problem with this approach is the WTO ain't what it used to be. It has been sort of in gridlock as a mechanism for moving forward further liberalization and integration of the international economy. Thanks partly to the US, it's on the verge of not being able to decide cases anymore. And the real action in trade now, and trade plus, trade and investment and things, is not WTO. It was TPP, now CPTPP, a variety of regional trade agreements, and so on. And particularly for Taiwan, this is a problem because China is the gatekeeper to many of those in a direct way and has influence in others. And finally, of course, ECFA itself, the Economic Cooperation Framework Agreement for Cross-Strait Relations, takes some of the bilateral economic relationship out of the immediate purview of the WTO. There are other organizations as well. The Asian Development Bank, Taiwan was grandfathered in. But the AIIB is kind of emerging as a different multilateral development bank and is shrinking the sort of relative share of the ADB. APEC was mentioned this morning. Taiwan gets to show up, but not with the kind of official representation that other states do. Newly emerging international economic organizations have been tougher. TPP, CPTPP, RCEP, FTAAP, AIIB, NDB, and the rest of the alphabet soup of organizations. These new ones are either China-centric, many of them are, or failing that, they're at least ones where Beijing will not allow Taiwan in, at least any time in the near future. Third strategy is to try to keep formal diplomatic relations where one can. Everybody knows this story. It was in the 20s under Ma, and then the diplomatic truce ended, and now we've seen it shrink down to 15. Taking diplomatic allies is not a new strategy. That's how the ROC got from many, many tens down to where it is. But it becomes a little more serious when the numbers get really small. And now the numbers are small, and they're especially small in Europe, where the Vatican is the only thing that's left, And in Africa, where Eswatini, I think that's how it's pronounced, formerly Swaziland, change your name, is the one African ally, and the Vatican is always considered to be at risk. It punches above its weight normatively in the international system. It's the only developed world ally that Taiwan has at this point, formal diplomatic relations. And there's always the concern that a deal with China over the place of bishops in the Catholic Church will perhaps lead to a defection there. Here I think the prospects are a little complicated. There is obviously a real downside to Taiwan in the drip, drip, drip loss of diplomatic recognition. We still live in a world where formalism matters. One could get really hardcore international law here and talk about the capacity to engage in relations with other states as being one of the four criteria for statehood. There's a debate about how formal that is, but formal helps. And of course, losing diplomatic allies has been a one-way ratchet. There's not been a whole lot of gains. There was one quite some time ago, but since then it's all been downhill and nobody's come back. There are some upsides here, I think, for Taiwan, though. There is no magic number. Maybe zero is a magic number, but 15, 16, 18, 13, I mean, when you're in small numbers, it's probably not a big deal to lose a few more. And of course, there is a kind of hydraulic pressure here. Part of the U.S. response to be more supportive of Taiwan, indeed specifically on the issue of encouraging other states to maintain diplomatic relations with Taiwan, is a response to China's squeeze on this front. And I think part of what's here in the legislation in Congress. And we saw the U.S. Recall ambassadors from three diplomatic countries in severed relations, Pompeo and others saying Tuvalu should stay on board and so on. And there is also a risk that if Beijing pushes this too far, the sensible move for Taiwan is to switch tactics. Stop talking about the handful of remaining diplomatic partners, if that drops to near zero, and instead stress the informal side of the capacity to engage in international relations, the fact that Taiwan has TECROs and their equivalents in many places around the world, and that's not something that's in Beijing's interest. Those last couple of points take us into the fourth strategy, which is maintaining strong informal relations with major powers, especially the United States and secondarily Japan. This is a squishy form of international space, but it matters. The TRA just turned 40, and it still stands as the second best alternative to what Taiwan lost in 79. It's something kind of like diplomatic relations, it's something kind of like a security relationship, and it's something kind of like being treated as a government and a state under U.S. law. Hardly perfect, but it's a pretty formal underpinning for informal relations. Now, there have been lots of ups and downs in U.S. support or closeness to Taiwan over the years since 79, but everybody in this room knows relations got to be quite positive under the Ming-Zhou and Obama administrations, especially against the backdrop of the latter part of the George W. Bush and Chun Shui-bian administrations. And under the Tsai and Trump eras, we've seen some volatility, some rocky points, some instability, but of course, in many ways, a remarkable upswing, which Bob described at length in the last panel, so he saved me some work here. I've done it better than I would have. There has been this uptake in the frequency, scale, and what you could call the wish list fulfillment of arms sales. There's been more pushback on China, where it's up to political pressure. The compatriots' anniversary speech in 2019, January, earlier this year, and the Hong Kong troubles fallout, as well as to the military pressures like flybys and sail arounds. Legislation, of course, has been part of the story too. It's been a long time since we've seen anything like the Taiwan Travel Act, the Asian Reassurance Initiative Act, ARIA, I love these, the Taipei Act, Taipei, which is working its way through the, I think it's to say Taipei because it's a P, I know, you're right, P. Fair enough. It's an old opinion, Wade Giles. Anyway, and of course the provisions in the National Defense Authorizations Act, which collectively have encouraged and supported moves that have been going on, I think, anyway, of higher level official contacts and somewhat closer security cooperation. And of course, there's a physical symbol of the brand new AIT building in Taipei. Tsai has gotten pretty generous transit diplomacy, and we can go through all of the markers. And of course, it benefits from the general anti-China vibe that everybody talks about in Washington, although one caution here, when Taiwan-U.S. relations become too much epiphenomenal on U.S.-China relations, that's not always the best thing for Taiwan. Finally, there's the as-if participation in major international structures, particularly the UN treaty regimes that Taiwan is not allowed to join. There are a bunch of examples here. I'll just give two of them. One is the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. We talked about the South and East China Seas earlier. And here Taiwan has essentially said, we know we don't get to join, but we're going to behave as if we are a member in good standing. So you have the Mingzhou East China Sea and South China Sea peace initiatives and the Tsai policies following on there, where there has been an insistence that all parties should follow international law, should keep a freedom of navigation and overflight, and should settle their disputes peacefully, ideally through multilateral processes that include the ROC at the table discussing them. And Taiwan tried its best to intervene in the famous Philippines-China-South China Sea arbitration. It threw a brief in over the transom, an extremely well-written, lawyerly brief on the status of Ituaba, or Taiping Dao, whether it could generate a maritime zone. The tribunal sort of paid attention to it while ignoring it. China, of course, didn't participate, but submitted a brief which the tribunal paid a lot of attention to. But you know, Taiwan is saying, we're playing by the rules, and we should be part of this because we have interests at stake. Basically an insistence that that Taiwan is behaving like a member of the regime in good standing would, a regime which, by the way, the U.S. has not joined, which creates a great talking point for Beijing when it pushes back against the U.S. in maritime spaces. Secondly, the human rights regime. Taiwan tried to deposit instruments of ratification for the two major covenants, the Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights and the Civil and Political Rights Covenant. The UN, not surprisingly, said no, but Mingzhou said, hey, too late, I left them on your doorstep. We are bound legally by the conventions, even if you don't take them. And Taiwan has built on that, bringing these laws into domestic law, the way a good member of the conventions would, and by doing something that is a sort of parallel to what the Universal Periodic Review process would be, self-scrutiny every 4 years under the two major covenants, including inviting international experts in to offer their critique, so it behaves as if it were part of the regime. And under Tsai, this is extended between beyond the two principal covenants to others, like the rights of the child and the rights of people with disabilities. UN climate change, Paris Accord is another example as well. So my last couple of minutes here, what do we take away from all this? Well, you know, it's a long-running and evolving multifaceted strategy. It adjusts to the times. But it's basically been pretty consistent. Try to preserve international space. It's a case of playing a weak hand well. Formality in international relations, international law, is often a weapon of the weak. That is W-E-A-K, not that it's trendy and it'll be gone in November. And what Taiwan, I think, can learn from its past experiences, its successes, and its failures, is there are a few things that make it more likely that some limited successes will be achieved. One is that a strategy is simply, or tactics really, of just taking opportunities where you can find them. So some things are going to be tough. State member organizations, state member only organizations, political rather than economic organizations, those are going to be tough, so go to the others. Participation or ad hoc access rather than full membership, again, it's been a more effective strategy. And in engaging either international organizations or treaties, it's been some, at least marginal help, sometimes more than that, to stress a few ideas. This is a truly universal regime. Why is Taiwan not in any way represented? That's kind of a moral claim, gets you a little leverage. Another is to say, if Taiwan isn't in this regime or this organization, it's bad for the regime or the organization. That gets somewhat more leverage. Taiwan's a big trading entity. It got into the WHA in a limited way, partly because SARS, which ran through Taiwan. You know, it's hard to have a complete civil aviation regime either if you don't include Taiwan and so on. Another kind of moral claim, which doesn't work quite as well perhaps, is to say that this is really important to Taiwan. Taiwan suffers if it's left out. That's probably better at signaling Taiwan's priorities than it is actually making big gains, but public health, WHA, SARS is one example. Interpol's become another, in part because of the penchant of several countries to return ROC citizens to the PRC for prosecution. And the civilian flight path and the possibility of military uses of that space near the center line of the strait is another example. So there are opportunities here. They're likely to remain fairly limited, but they should be pressed. Then there's playing the values card to secure international space, joining institutions where it can and treaties, and behaving as if it were a good member, a member in good standing where it can't get in. And here I think, you know, you've seen some progress. The problem of, you know, so you've seen Taiwan stress that it supports liberal or open regimes for the international economy, for the law of the sea, for human rights, in pointed contrast to Beijing, and that's been part of the game here, of course, because it draws in some support from the U.S. and like-minded states. There are some weaknesses in this strategy because the liberal rules-based international order is crumbling. The U.S. is not supporting it the way it used to, and China is engaged in a fairly assertive attempt to undermine or at least kick up a little dust, particularly on values and to some degree on institutions. And finally, it's a somewhat passive strategy or passive tactic, But Taiwan can capitalize on the phenomenon of political hydraulic pressure, or the second law of political thermodynamics, by which I mean that for every action there is, well, not equal and opposite, but some kind of reaction that pushes back in the other direction. So Chinese assertiveness has brought more U.S. and other external support to Taiwan and international space opportunities for Taiwan. Where China has squeezed Taiwan's international space really hard, there is a risk that the shift in tactics that I talked about earlier could happen. And finally, excessive pressure on Taiwan or about Taiwan from Beijing can backfire in terms of Taiwan's domestic politics. I joke that Xi Jinping should be named Tsai Ing-wen's honorary campaign chairman because the Taiwan anniversary speech and the Hong Kong troubles have been about the best thing that he or anyone could have done for her. So let's tune in January 2020 and see where this all lands.
Terrific.
Great job.
Well, thank you very much, Jacques, and appreciate you sticking absolutely to time. And we will now hear from Bonnie Glaser on prospects for Taiwan. One's broader political engagement and challenges, and she's going to speak from the podium.
Thank you, Fiona and Deepa and the Cedar Center for having me back. Always fun to come over to GW and talk about Taiwan and cross-strait relations, as I've done many times before, but I feel like I have some new things to talk about today. It's a great topic. I think I'm basically going to elaborate on what Jacques referred to as the fourth category, the informal mechanisms, the ways that Taiwan can advance its international space through sort of informal means, bilateral, and also to some extent multilateral. So I want to start by saying a couple of things about why participation in the international community is important to Taiwan. And Jacques has already made a good case, but I think there's some more things that can be said. Taiwan wants to be able to share its expertise with the rest of the world, whether it's in health or environment, technology. It needs to have reliable access to information. So if it's not in Interpol, it's not part of the 24/7 database, it can't get timely access to lists of, let's say, criminals if they're holding a very big, like, athletic competition, like the Summer University Games. So it has to rely on, you know, the FBI to get that information. We'll get it off the database and share it with Taiwan. So that's another reason. Taiwan learns more about international standards, solving disputes according to international laws and norms. Importantly, can demonstrate its image as a good global citizen, as Jacques made the point, especially in comparison to China. So that's something that it can do when it participates in international fora. And of course, it can increase its interaction with other countries through networking in these organizations. So if it's at, you know, the WTO, or if it's at APEC, then it has access to other countries that are there. It can have side meetings, and it can use that to further amplify, you know, the impact of that particular meeting and strengthen its interaction with other countries. So a few just numbers. Taiwan is now a full member of 37 international organizations, and it enjoys observer or other status in 21 other international organizations. And their subsidiary bodies. So many of these organizations, Taiwan, of course, did not enter as a state member. It's entered as a separate customs territory, a fishing entity, a non-sovereign, you know, regional member. So there are various ways, statuses that Taiwan is used to enter organizations. Sometimes organizations that are functionally based, that deal with a particular issue, like fisheries, have been easier for Taiwan to participate in. So I'm really going to spend most of my time on talking about some of the strategies that the United States has used with Taiwan, and Taiwan is also using, to enhance its ability to participate in the region and in the international community in the absence of having the ability to join these like UN-affiliated organizations. And the one that comes to, of course, everybody's mind first is the Global Cooperation Training Framework, the GCTF.